Hi, this is Doug Wood.
And this is Patty Wood from Green Street. Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, is the most important environmental issue facing New York today.
Fracking brings together issues of environmental justice, human health, conservation, sustainability, property rights, political power, money, and just plain greed.
And you know, there are better ways to solve our energy problems. Jeopardizing our health, safety, and future can't be the answer.
So WBAI is supporting AMillionFrackingLetters.com, a citizens' campaign organizing letters to Governor Cuomo.
It's democracy at its best. Please visit AMillionFrackingLetters.com today.
And join us every other Tuesday night at 8 on Green Street, right here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Hi, this is Doug Wood.
And this is Patty Wood from Green Street. Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking.
Welcome, this is Barbara Glickstein. You're tuned into WBAI and it's Health Styles, brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College. You can find out more about the center and the show Health Styles, as well as see our blog, Health Cetera, at centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. On this segment of Health Styles, which I've titled The Public Health Threat of Climate Change, is Hurricane Sandy's aftermath in New York City in a public health created a public health crisis? And is this what we're going to see as a new normal based on climate change? So on this segment of Health Styles, I'll be talking with a nurse who would requested to remain anonymous, and we'll refer to her as Betty. And she currently works in the emergency room in New York City and will be sharing some of her insights on how things have been in New York City emergency rooms, or in the emergency room that she's familiar with, as well as her colleagues in emergency rooms across the city since Sandy hit New York City on October 29th. The crises in the New York City hospitals, both in the inpatient and outpatient clinics, have been facing. What we know is that as of November 28th, Bellevue Hospital Center, Coney Island Hospital, in Long Island, Long Beach Medical Center, which we won't be discussing this evening, Manhattan VA Medical Center, and NYU Langone Medical Center have basically been closed. They're in the process of reopening some departments, mostly outpatient departments and clinics. In the Bellevue situation included the evacuation of all of their patients, and an article that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in November 14th, there's discussion with a Dr. Danielle Ulfrey, who talked about not only did the hospital evacuate all of their patients, but over 4,000 faculty and staff have now been dispersed throughout New York City's five boroughs in the health and hospital corporations, of which Bellevue is a member. At New York University as well, all of those patients were evacuated after the storm hit, and all of their staff have also been dispersed throughout New York City, from what I understand, largely to Lenox Hill Hospital and other hospital centers throughout New York City. In addition to the patients and staff in these hospitals, as someone who teaches at the Hunter Bellevue College of Nursing, all of the clinical sites for professional training and education have been severely hit by the closure of these major medical centers in New York City, and scrambling has been happening in the departments of nursing in our New York City clinical departments, and trying to make placements for students in both undergraduate and graduate programs. It's something that I have not seen a lot in the news about. I definitely have seen that report about the continued closure, but I think that what I hope to accomplish on this segment of Health Styles with my guest, who we'll refer to as Betty, who is an emergency room nurse, is to kind of get some up close and stories about really what it's been like in terms of coping under these kinds of conditions, staff being sent to other medical centers to work. Lenox Hill, I understand, on the Upper East Side was operating under capacity before Sandy. It's a 600-bed facility, and since then they have been overbooked and having operating rooms staying booked well into the evening and on the weekends. And what Lenox Hill did, who was struggling financially, is they fast-tracked admitting credentials to about 300 NYU doctors and employed close to 500 of the NYU nurses. New York Presbyterian Weill Cornell Medical Center, also on the Upper East Side, was historically, up until even before Sandy, not necessarily concerned about more patients or taking on more physicians and staff, because they were definitely trying to keep pace with an increased number of people who were coming into the emergency room following the closure of St. Vincent's Medical Center here in New York City about 2 years ago. So we had a system in a bit of overload in some areas and in crisis. And then we certainly know that Bellevue, which was the largest shuttered facility in Coney Island, being part of New York City's Health and Hospitals Corporation, servicing urgent care, specialty clinics, and primary clinics, which are mainly still all closed. So with that brief introduction about sort of the state of where things are as of today, I welcome a colleague and friend who is an ER nurse who will be speaking with us under the pseudonym Betty. So thank you for joining us this evening on Health Styles, and I'm really pleased to be able to have a conversation with you on the air about the impact of Hurricane Sandy and what may be a potential public health at risk for people in New York City as a result of it. So welcome to Health Styles.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here and talk about this ongoing concern. So
would you start by sharing where you were on the night that of October 29th when Sandy hit? Were you working that evening in the ER, or were you at home and worried about and concerned about trying to get into the borough to work at the Manhattan hospital that you are an ER nurse at?
I was actually at home. I was off that day, so I was at home, and I made a phone call to my patient care director, and I said, you know, I live in Queens. The bridges are closed, but I do know that I would easily be able to get a ride with a member of service, either a friend who is a police officer or a paramedic or an EMT, because they were allowing members of service to cross the bridges at that time. But she said, well, you know, we're actually very much overstaffed right now because we have people who haven't been able to go home. So at this time, we don't need any additional help. So that was that Sunday night that I called, and the same thing on Monday, and then the same thing on Tuesday. And so I ended up going to work the day after the storm. So Wednesday was the first day that I reported to work, which was the day directly after the storm.
And what did you return to at that time? Was it a different environment having arrived?
Oh, it was. So I've been a nurse 9 years, and I've seen, you know, many variations of what we call disasters in the emergency room, just from, you know, outbreaks of public health issues and local epidemics and, you know, underserved populations. But what I saw when I came back to my emergency room, which is a level one trauma and burn center, is I saw a lot of mass units. We had so many patients that were displaced. We had patients that were, you know, we set up a mass unit in the lobby of the hospital, which is an area normally where you just sort of walk through to get to your elevator with a 10-bed unit. We set up a portable dialysis center in the waiting areas on the second and third floor because we have atriums in that part of the facility. We had also the hallways that are outside of our emergency room that you just get to x-ray, radiology, CAT scan, and the administrative offices. They were all lined with patients. And that's in addition to the patients actually inside the emergency room. I saw staff that had not left in 2 or 3 days, but, you know, they were coming and going in shifts. The hospital had set up hotel rooms next door and nearby. They were getting rest and on-call rooms. You know, their meals were getting paid for. I actually got reimbursed for my cab fare to come in. And so it was a state of you know, just that first day right after the storm, I saw instantly just a huge number of patients who were displaced. And it's something that I've never seen before.
And without, obviously, specifics, were they patients displaced from the closed facilities that I mentioned, either Bellevue, NYU Langone, the VA hospital on 23rd Street, or Coney Island Hospital?
Yes, they were. All those patients.
I also want to add another critical piece to this conversation, which is the nursing homes and residential assistance for the elderly that were also those folks who live in those residences, many of them with health issues and chronic health conditions, and some of the stories that we've heard about the poor management in one particular facility that happened in East Rockaway, that patients were not evacuated soon enough, and as a result, there was a dispersal of those nursing home residents to shelters and other facilities without the proper medical records or with notification to families as to where they were being transferred. I believe that even as late as last week, there were family members just being reunited after not knowing where a loved one had been placed. So we're not going to be talking globally about all of those kinds of facilities, but specifically, this is Barbara Glickstein. You're listening to Health Styles. Tonight's segment is talking about the public health potential for a public health crisis as a result of the closing of some major medical centers in New York City, going on now over 4 weeks since the Hurricane Sandy and its aftermath, the closure of NYU Langone Hospital, Bellevue Medical Center, the Veterans Administration Hospital on 23rd Street, and First Coney Island Hospital, and on Long Island, Long Beach Hospital, which is also closed and not part of this conversation. So you entered into your facility on that Wednesday. You refer to them as MASH units. I had an immediate visual on that. But thank you for describing the amount of space that it was required, and in addition, the ER being packed. And so did most of those patients arrive with the proper medical documentation as to what their health needs were needed, or was there some chaos around that?
We actually had patients arriving with their proper medical records intact. I guess when what the issue started really, really happening, because receiving patients from one facility to another facility, that actually was a very streamlined process. You know, we had a command center in place. We had a disaster team in place. We had the entire disaster protocol in place the day before Sandy hit. And so it was very much a streamlined process. The issue that I feel was actually almost a little more prevalent, at least from my perspective at my emergency room, was if you take Manhattan and the millions of people that live in Manhattan, now I'm speaking strictly about Manhattan now, and you start from the area where Bellevue is and you go up to, you know, further up to where around the Upper East Side and up in Harlem, you will pass, you know, a lot of hospitals that have closed, albeit the VA, NYU, even Beth Israel was closed for a period of 2 weeks. So was Metropolitan Hospital, was closed for several weeks because they flooded as well. You have millions of patients who would normally go to these hospitals and for their routine care and also their emergency room care, for their dialysis, for their doctor visits, for their surgeries. And so not only was it the patients who were in the hospitals who were displaced, but it's the patients who would normally, you know, go to these facilities in search of their medical care. And so, you know, that actually was where so much more of our volume came from, because you have millions of people within, you know, the first 10 miles of Manhattan from Bellevue on up to the Upper East Side and up to Harlem who had no hospital to go to. And so, you know, they found themselves having to travel far uptown, which, you know, in New York, anytime you have to travel far uptown, it's kind of a big deal. You know, if it's not within a few blocks, it's not convenient. And so you have all of these people who were displaced who weren't even in the hospital to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And that is actually what we have seen as the most prevalent issue since the flood hit.
And in those kinds of people who were arriving into emergency rooms who normally wouldn't be using an emergency room, what kinds of requests were being made in it? things like prescription renewals or flus, coughs, colds, in addition to, you mentioned, patients on dialysis. Where did all of those patients go for their dialysis needs?
So we set up a portable dialysis clinic basically in some lobbies within my hospital, and they called in, you know, their full dialysis staff, and they would bring people in, dialyze them, and discharge them, or they would help them arrange transportation with a sister ride or another form of transportation to an alternate dialysis facility. Another issue that we saw was what we call more so social issues. Now, New York City, you have a lot of high rises. You know, the entire lower Manhattan was out of power for a period of almost 2 weeks. And so imagine if you are an 82-year-old female who lives on the 10th floor or the 32nd floor of a high rise and you have no power and you're also on home oxygen. Normally you would use your elevator. It's not a problem for you. You're able to fully function. But imagine if you wipe out that elevator. Now, how exactly are you going to get down 32 flights of stairs and up 32 flights of stairs? So we had a lot of what we call social admits, people who had no power. You know, the 90-year-old gentleman who's been living in the Lower East Side for 90 years, who has no power, who has no food, who uses home oxygen, who needs a BiPAP machine at nighttime. So all of those people who strictly were affected by power and geographical location, they all had to come to the hospital as well because there were no other sources and there were no other resources for them to go to. So our EMS providers were carrying people down 30 and 40 and even, you know, 50 flights of stairs just to bring them into the hospital because it's an elderly patient who cannot get out of their home because they live so far up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just that was also another huge issue.
I read on the Health and Hospital Health and Human Services website in preparation for this conversation what some of the continued support is, and then a little bit about what was going on in the early weeks of this. And there are currently 25 ambulances that remain deployed in New York City through Health and Human Services to assist with the continued need for emergency management. And actually, these ambulances were deployed from other areas of the country under the FEMA contract. And at the height of the response, there were over 350 ambulances that were deployed to the New York City area. So when you talk about what the overtaxing needs for EMS were, there was these 350 additional ambulances, certainly during the evacuations, and we all have very vivid images of the evacuation of NYU and Bellevue, of the lines of ambulances dispatching to different parts of the city to remove patients, some of whom were quite critical in need. So talk a little bit about the tax on the system and what things were like before October 29th in the emergency room, particularly because of the seasonal time of the year. We know that it's that time of the year from colds and flus, and people who have respiratory problems who develop a cold have maybe an exacerbation of their asthma. So what's a typical, October, end of October scenario compared to then the next day or that Wednesday when you got back in?
So typically around this season, you know, the emergency room is going to have its busy days. You know, the busiest days are Monday and Tuesday, and then you also have your Friday and Saturdays that are pretty busy. A lot of patients flowing in with influenza-like illness, a lot of people with chronic healthcare needs that are just exacerbated. But the issue is that you're going to have days that are very busy and then days that are not as busy, sort of what we call the roller coaster of the emergency room. And every emergency room understands that some days it's busy and some days it's not. Some days we have a lot of empty beds in the hospital and patients who are admitted can go right upstairs, and some days it's not and they have to wait a few hours. However, after the hurricane hit and even continuing up until this day and until all those hospitals reopen, there is no such thing as a not busy day. The emergency room are full to the brim with patients. You know, they have 40 and 50 and 60 patients who are waiting in the emergency room just to be admitted to the hospital, you know, but there are no beds in the hospital. And this is a 24-hour cycle now. There's no up and down. It's just a constant period of up because the census in the emergency room has risen so much that, you know, not only is there no room in the hospital to keep the admitted patients, but the emergency room still has all of the emergency room patients coming in as well. So that normal roller coaster cycle of up and down time that we normally see this year and all of the healthcare concerns that come along with it is now basically just rotated to a stage of up and very, very busy, and there is no downtime just because the volume has increased, you know, tenfold. You know, we are actually, at the hospital I work at, we're sending patients to hospitals upstate and way uptown, you know, 100, 200, 300 blocks away because they have open beds, they have available beds, and so we're transferring our stable patients up there so they're not sitting in the emergency room for 40 and 50 hours. You know, so in addition to the regular health concerns of, you know, influenza-like illness and other things, you know, we're still dealing with just the massive amount of volume, because when you take away 2, 3, 4 hospitals in a such a densely populated area as Manhattan, you have to think about how many millions of people those hospitals serve, and now they all have to go to, you know, just a handful of hospitals. And so that, you know, that has really been a confounding variable in just the volume, and nothing has really changed as far as the presentation of patients' illnesses before and after the hurricane. Nothing that I haven't already spoken on, but it's just the volume. There is no downtime now. And, you know, that's probably the biggest issue there.
The New York City Department of Health, Commissioner Farley reported earlier this week that there's been a triple in numbers of people showing up with hypothermia, compared to last year at this time, many of them related to Hurricane Sandy, most likely those who were in the storm and devastated by the storm in water for periods of time that created hypothermia. And then, of course, as you've mentioned, those who have continue to be without power and heat, there's an increase. There's also been an increase in some carbon monoxide concerns with people using gas ranges for long periods of time without proper ventilation. And something else which wasn't reported by in that same Department of Health update, but something people are referring to as the Sandy cough, similar to after 9/11, where rescue workers and those who are there now pulling out, mold-drenched plywood and boards are developing a cough. And I'm wondering if you've seen any of that in the emergency room.
We actually have seen some cough, some hypothermia, actually a lot of electrocutions, because whenever you mix, you know, downed power lines and water, you have a very, very viable environment for electrocutions. So electrocutions, a lot of burns, from people using space heaters or people trying to find a way to light the pilot light of their gas stove just to heat their apartment, the cough. The hypothermia was a very large issue directly after the storm and for that period of about 2.5 weeks when, you know, so many people were without power. But that, since the power is, you know, continuously being restored, that's not as big of an issue as it was. But those period of, you know, 2 or 3 weeks after the storm, the electrocutions, the burns, the hypothermia, the cough, you know, people coming in who have malnutrition, who just have not ate in several days, dehydration, people who have not been drinking, you know, those were the most Sandy related, you know, concerns as far as, you know, stable patients were that were presenting. But we see it's very, very textbook, you know, whenever you have a disaster, the types of, you know, complaints and concerns that are associated with that and the type of patients it brings in. And those were Sandy's textbook complaints. Those right there.
We have just a moment left. Betty, which is not your real name. We're talking with a nurse here this evening on Health Styles. I'm Barbara Glickstein, who works in an emergency room in New York City that has remained open about the impact of Hurricane Sandy on the public health systems here in New York and the hospital system. So in the moment that we have left, will you comment whether, one, what would you advise our listeners in terms of their needs for health if it's a non-emergency situation? Where are you diverting people to, if you have that answer? And second, what are your hopes for our ability to address the need to learn from this experience with Hurricane Sandy as an emergency room nurse?
So first and foremost, I would advise anybody, if it is not a life-threatening emergency, go to an urgent care clinic. Go to the local city MDs that are popping up all around New York City. Call a primary care clinic and make an appointment with the physician, because they can give you the care that you need quicker and more efficiently. And at the end of the day, quick and more efficient is always going to be better for the patient and the provider. Do not come to the emergency room unless you have a life-threatening illness or injury, because the emergency room, is not the appropriate place for that. However, now with this massive influx of other patients from other areas, you're going to sit in the emergency room for 12 hours, and all that you're going to get, is some Robitussin for your cough and some Tylenol for your fever, and you're going to be told to go home and get some rest. So non-emergent medical concerns, go to a local clinic, go to an urgent care center. There's lots of them throughout the city. And as far as a lesson that we can all, take from this, I've been a nurse about 9 years, and I have never been involved in such a disaster, but I can definitely comment that the city of New York and the hospitals teamed up together so quickly. And, granted, it's always a very, 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 important decision to make the choice to evacuate a large medical center. You have patients on ventilators, you have patients who are walking, and all the staff. It's such a big deal. But, something that we can all learn from this is that, there's always going to be a disaster plan in place, and there's always going to be effects after the fact, and they can go on for months. So, just because the power is back on and people are going back home, it doesn't mean that the effects are not going to still be felt. We'll be feeling the effects of this for 8 months to a year, until NYU and Bellevue and Coney Island hospitals and the VA all open back up. So it's very important for healthcare workers to know what the resources are that they can use so they don't get burnt out. And it's also important for them to know the update and the status of the other facilities, and also resources that they can reach out to patients with, just to help in the general concern. So.
Well, thank you. I want to thank you for taking the time to be with us this evening on Health Styles. My guest is an emergency room nurse who has asked to remain anonymous while we have an upfront and updated conversation about the crisis in the emergency rooms in New York City following Hurricane Sandy. My name is Barbara Glickstein. You've been tuned into Health Styles, brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College. Find out more about us on our blog, HealthCetera, at centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Thank you for listening. I hope that you're well and that you continue to remain well. And stay tuned.
And stay tuned to WBAI in New York City, which this is. And it's coming back. We are coming back. I heard someone on Barbara's program say, in the moment... And in the moment, we'll be here immediately after Radio Unnameable this morning at 3 o'clock. So stay tuned. This is WBAI in New York City.
Good evening. In the news tonight... Workers walk out at dozens of fast food restaurants in New York to demand better wages and the right to unionize. With many tenants still reeling from Hurricane Sandy, elected officials ask for an extension of a moratorium on evictions, and activists rally in Foley Square to support Jeremy Hammond, who faces life in prison if convicted of giving hacked computer files to WikiLeaks. With these and other stories, I'm Andrea Sears in New York, and this is the news for Thursday, November 29th, 2012. The United Nations voted overwhelmingly today to recognize a Palestinian state, a long-sought victory for the Palestinians, but an embarrassing diplomatic defeat for the United States. The resolution upgrading the Palestinian status to a non-member observer state at the United Nations was approved by a more than two-thirds majority of the 193-member world body, a vote of 138-9 with 41 abstentions. A Palestinian flag was quickly unfurled on the floor of the General Assembly behind the Palestinian delegation. Real independence